Hi, I'm Ken Sweeney. This is The Comfortable Spot. Welcome. Hi everyone, Ken here, your host from The Comfortable Spot. Today, I have a special bonus episode for you. But before I reveal what that is, I just wanted to say thank you to you all for supporting the series over the last 25 episodes. I also want to say thank you for all your lovely messages telling me how much you enjoy The Comfortable Spot. It's been a real privilege to chat to all my guests, and I promise I have many more to come. And remember, if you do enjoy the series and haven't done so already, don't forget to give it a rating on your favourite podcast platform. Ratings really help spread the word. So now, onto the bonus episode. My guest is professional racing driver Richard Jones. This is a recording I made last year as a pilot episode for a motor racing podcast series. Now, the series didn't come to fruition, but it did result in some excellent episodes, including this one with Richard. Richard specialised in sports car racing, in particular the Group C category, which was extremely popular in the 1980s. Group C boasted huge crowds, popular teams, and famous drivers. This is a little more specialised episode than usual, but I do hope you'll stay with us, as Richard is a great conversationalist and a wonderful guest. So much so that, since this chat, we've become really great friends. So, now without further ado, let's meet Richard, and as always, I hope you're sitting comfortably and happy to stay with us. Richard, hi, how are you?
Oh, hi, Ken. Yeah, good, thank you.
Thanks for joining me on the podcast today. It's really great to get a chance to somebody who was actually there at the time about Group C racing. Can you tell me a little bit about how Group C came about? I mean, what was the sports car scene like at the time?
Well, immediately prior to C2, it was Group 6. And that was a world championship. And it ran not alongside F1, but it was, you know, every other weekend when it wasn't an F1 race. It was some great racing, open top, which I love. I like having my head in the fresh air, but that's another story. That's my single seater head on. Mm-hmm. It was a very special era, and I was disappointed when it all changed, and we'll probably get onto that later about all that. But mm-hmm. And it was my first Le Mans, which of course was 78, which is always very special.
The Group 6 series, was that getting a bit tired? Was it lacking manufacturer and team input? And is that why they came up with the Group C idea?
Well, no, that was why I was rather mystified, because it was very strong. There were a number of F1 drivers were in the championship. You know, my first race, I was racing Formula Ford in England, and racing against Graham Hill, Henry Pescarolo, Dadamich, Merzario, mm-hmm. at the other weekends. I mean, it was bizarre, you know, but great fun. And I drove 2 litre and 3 litre Group 6. But at the beginning, it was 2 litre.
And the Group C series, it was conceived obviously as a global series. Was their initial idea to kind of bring the Americans in on it? Was that the idea, that they were going to make it an international series? Or was it always going to be that America would have a separate but similar type of racing?
Right. Well, it's all so political, this, but because there was the FIA or FISA at the time, FISA stroke FIA, the ACO at Le Mans, and IMSA in America. Mm. Now, the FIA weren't really that bothered about the Americans coming over to Europe together to race, and likewise, I don't think that they weren't particularly bothered either of coming. So, but Le Mans always attracted the Americans, and there was still, to this day, the sort of conflict between the regs for IMSA and the regs for the ACO and the FIA regs, because they're all, you know, they're all power mad and want to control everything themselves. So that's an opinion, of course. So it was, I think, because Group 6 was still strong. I mean, so it was politics. And to be honest, at the time, I'm a driver. I'm not a politician. So I just had to go with the flow. So I couldn't change anything. So that was it. But that was why it changed, I think, because something to do within all that politics is why it changed,
right,
in my opinion.
And how did you actually get into the series? I mean, Group C, was it something that you stumbled into, or did you always have a plan to get in there?
Well, no, it was just a natural progression, because the privateers in Group 6 became privateers in Group C.
Right.
So it was almost business as usual, really, except we were driving a different type of car. But so from my perspective as a driver, it was just not a lot changed except for the car I was driving.
Okay. And was there, just digressing slightly, was there a big difference between Group 6 and, say, the original first generation C cars?
No, except they stuck a roof on it for some reason. That was it.
And a lot, of course, there was a lot of conversions, wasn't there? There was a couple of conversions from Group 6 to C1, wasn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. So to drive, apart from not getting that nice fresh air and breathing in the smell of the barbecues at night at Le Mans and things like that, you know, which I missed. But anyway, it's what it was. And it's still a fantastic event, of course.
Mm.
It's an honour to drive those sorts of cars. It really is.
And just in regards to driving, did you drive for certain particular teams, or did you have a wide range of teams that you drove for at the time?
I can only describe myself as a journeyman, I suppose, mm-hmm. because there were a lot of good drivers there that were paying for drives, which was very irritating to somebody like me. But I understand, especially with the privateers, if they could get a good driver who's paying them a lot of money to drive it, I mean, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? But so I used to finish up getting a lot of last-minute drives with mm-hmm. whoever was stuck without a driver, because they hadn't found one of those guys. That's roughly the story.
And the series was broken into two categories, C1 and C2. Now, I know you had experience in both of those categories, so could you tell me, was there big differences in performance between the two categories?
Yes, with an odd exception, which was a C2 where we had a Formula One Tolman engine in it for qualifying 1 year.
Okay.
It was quite exciting.
Right.
But they didn't. The establishment didn't like that.
So in terms of performance, would a C2 be able to keep up with the C1 in qualifying and then lose overall in the race? Was that how it would work?
Well, no. Look, they're both C2 are quick cars. Mm. C1s are quicker cars. And the C2, according to the regs, was not supposed to out-qualify a C1 car. But Hugh Chamberlain, bless him, being him, and Brian Hart, who built Formula One engines for turbocharged Formula One engines for Tolman. The F1 regs became redundant, and Brian had got racks full of engines with them, and they didn't have anywhere to go. And so he did a deal with Hugh, or Hugh did a deal with Brian, to build those engines from 1500cc to 2 litre. Turbocharged for the C2 sports car racing, and there was nothing in the regs that said we couldn't do it. And I think it was 87 or 88, we put it on the fourth row. We were C2 pole by about 10 rows.
Wow.
and on the fourth row of the grid at Le Mans. So it made for an interesting start, because we had to turn the boost right down. So the first few laps were quite interesting, and I took the start that year. So it was, No, to answer the question, the C2 cars were supposed to be a lot slower, but on one occasion we got round the regs and got right up there, right up the sharp end of the C1 grid, but it never happened again.
In terms of the actual, say, technology behind the cars, particularly around, say, 88 to 91, when the manufacturer team started to kind of invest a lot more, Were the off-the-shelf cars, like, say, the Spice or the Gerhards and all, were they simpler in terms of design and manufacturing, or did they have the same level of, say, technology invested in them?
No, they didn't have the same mm-hmm. amount of technology invested in them. I mean, the works teams were always going to beat us, in fairness. So we just, I mean, they're multi million pounds, tens of millions of pounds budgets, and we were very good at doing well on a much, 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 much smaller budget. So the honest answer is, yeah, the technology wasn't there. It was a long time. Obviously, the main difference between Group 6 cars and Group C cars was the when the serious ground effect came in.
Mm-hmm.
So the Spice was really the first privateer type car that you could buy off the shelf with the ground effect. And I think that answers the question.
Let's talk about the factory teams for a second. We had Lancia, Porsche, Mercedes, Jaguar, Aston Martin, I think Toyota, Nissan, and then Mazda, along with, you know, a splatter of others that were maybe, you know, kind of half committed. Why do you think so many manufacturers were attracted to Group C racing at that time?
Those guys are hard-nosed business people.
Mm.
They would not have done that unless it made commercial sense, and it did. It gave all those manufacturers a global platform for their products. And the jewel in the crown is to win Le Mans. If you win Le Mans, the next day in the showrooms, and this is fact, you had to put extra staff on. It sold cars like you wouldn't believe. I know it sounds strange, but it's a fact. And also, if you're selling cars all over the world, if you're selling German cars in Australia and you've got dealerships in Australia and you go and do the Australian Grand Prix and you invite all the dealers, I mean, it's a whole package, and it made commercial sense and they made money out of it. And if they stopped making money out of it, they stopped racing.
Right.
And left us privateers.
And Richard, I wanted to ask you about the privateers. How important were they to Group C?
Well, in a word, Ken, they were very important, because if they weren't there, there wouldn't have been enough cars on the grid to make it viable. Because in the highly unlikely event that they all ran three cars, it still would only make, you know, whatever, 15 cars, and that doesn't make a grid. And also, manufacturers come and go.
That's very true.
And the privateers are the constants. I mean, it was the same privateers that, other privateers would come and go, but there was a real Chamberlain being a classic example, you know, that had been there through the Group 6 and Group C. So they were the constants, and the manufacturers were, you know, they'd come and go. In fact, we used to pull the leg about that, because there's a lot of camaraderie, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, we all knew lots of the boys that worked for the manufacturers, because they'd all worked for privateers before they went. And when the manufacturers went away, they came back to the privateers. So it was all a very close bond. So, you're back with us now, are you? Yeah, mm-hmm. No, they've deserted you. So, no, I mean, the privateers, the privateers wouldn't have been there without the manufacturers, and the manufacturers wouldn't have been there without the privateers. So it worked all around, really.
So there was a good symbiosis going on at the time. And I wanted to ask you about, because I noticed when, even, like, I was in my teens when Group C was racing, but I used to get to watch it on Screen Sport at the time, which eventually became Eurosport. What I noticed about that, and actually looking as well, as you talk about, say, when in the aftermath of a win at Le Mans in particular, and even in America, I'm sure with Daytona, the 24-hour race there, what I always noticed about that was there was almost a football-like atmosphere at the races, and it almost seemed like a national sense of pride existed when it came to, in particular, the factory teams. Unlike Formula One, Group C seemed to have this. Was that a positive thing in the series?
Oh, yes. I think this was really very, very important thing. What I'd like to do is to use a footballing analogy.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, the build-up to the start at Le Mans in particular was like the World Cup final. And the final consisted of Germany, Italy, Japan and France in the final, you know. So you can imagine that. And the amazing thing was that I was on the pitch. So it was absolutely brilliant atmosphere. But the big difference was there was no crowd violence, just a large, extremely knowledgeable crowd. They knew the drivers, they knew the cars, they knew who should be where. I mean, and particularly on the Mulsanne Strait, there's one of the marshal posts is always manned by all Brits. So every time you went past in a British car, they all, you know, went particularly mad. And it was just such a very, very special thing. And it's difficult to describe, but hopefully I'm giving you guys a feel for it.
Formula One has always been associated with teams McLaren, Ferrari, Tyrrell going back a few years and so on. But I think, as you say, with Group C, it was the actual manufacturers, and they were flag waving their origin, weren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. There were a lot of Union Jacks, especially in 1988 when the Jags won.
Yeah, I see. You're absolutely correct, because it didn't seem to matter if the drivers were not from the UK.
No, that was a wonderful atmosphere. And there was, mm-hmm. I mean, it was a camaraderie among the crowd, you know, and it was, just so special.
And it
always has been. I mean,
and was it similar in the United States? I mean, was there kind of a similar feeling in the United States if you raced there?
There were always a lot of flags in America, mm-hmm. but there was only one of them.
Yes, we shan't go into this. In this current atmosphere, I get exactly what you mean. And just sticking with IMSA as well, I mean, how important was the American Series at the time, say, compared to Group C?
Well, I raced in IMSA, and it was very kind to me, IMSA, but it was never the same. I mean, the closest you get would be Daytona 24 Hours, and Sebring is special. Yeah. I found Sebring more special.
That was the race that was raced on the airfield, is that right? That's a 12-hour race.
Still is. It's a 12-hour, and it's a wacky track, I tell you. You know, it's built by those massive B-52 bombers base or something. When you get out on the back straight's just, you know, you just, first time I went around, I finished up about 2 miles away from the track.
Yes, it looks like that when you're watching it, all right. These big, massive slabs of concrete, you know.
Yeah. But another little story about Sebring was, and talking about driving open cars there, which I did early on, there's a particular corner where there's a big crowd of crazy fans all building huge cones of beer cans and smoking something different, let's put it that way. And as you drove past it, you know, you actually got high going around the corner, you know. you had to hold your breath as you went through.
So there was a health and safety warning around the rear end.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't think the Americans, they didn't really seem to like coming to Europe. They weren't that quick when they came. And we used to do well in the States against them. So I don't know, but they were very insular. Preston Henn was an exception to that. He ran a 956 or a 962 in Europe, quite successfully. But and a great guy. But he's the only one that stands out. So no, they weren't as important. They were an aside in my view.
But there was a good standard of American drivers still racing in America. People like Danny Sullivan and so on. They did transfer well to the European cars, though, did they?
Yeah. Yes and no, but no, they didn't come. Not they didn't come in the droves.
Right.
You know, at all. No. But I think IMSA. Well, singles. I think the American public either the two camps really. There's NASCAR and IndyCar, and somehow IMSA fell in the middle, and that's my view because. You know, I'd love to have driven at Indy, but I never did. Mm-hmm. That was an ambition.
Yeah,
I fulfilled most of them, but that's one that I missed. I don't think I'll get in there now.
I don't think you'd want to be there now. It looks a bit too quick, I think, for the average human being almost at this point. No.
Well, they were pretty quick then. But and I tell you what, they weren't as quick as the fastest car down the Mulsanne Straight.
Right. That would have been I mean, they were coming up to 2-3-5 miles per hour at one point, weren't they, before they put the chicanes in?
No, well, in qualifying, the Peugeot holds the fastest time was at I think it's 256 miles per hour.
That's the Evo one from 1992 or something like that, was it?
Ooh, right. Okay,
yeah, I know. We're both guessing. I think we leave it at the fact that we know it was the Peugeot.
But I'd also, I went down there in a C1 dome. Mm-hmm. I think we were 2:46 through the speed trap just before the kink. And that was the last race before the chicanes, I think.
Right. And the dome was a Japanese designed and built car, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I could almost claim to be a works dome driver because in qualifying, the works car crashed at the S's big time in qualifying. Totally wrecked it, and they couldn't repair it. And I was driving for Dorset Racing, my great friend Tony Birchenoff, rest in peace, Tony, who bought the previous year's Dome. And I was driving that. I know Nick Four was one of the other drivers. I can't remember who the third one may have been. Anyway, doesn't matter. It's all on the record somewhere. And that was an amazing car. But because, so the works, Tony got the deal of a lifetime because the Dome had got 300 guests arriving or something and hadn't got a car. So they sort of, I think they bought the car back off Tony. And yeah. So we ran it as the works car.
Wow. I mean, you could never do that nowadays, but back then it was just probably just something that you could just do at the last minute.
I'll tell you what year that was in a minute. I think that was 84, yeah.
Going back to the championship itself, I mean, Group C effectively collapsed around 1993. There was a lot of regulation changes, and they also, there was cars like the 962 being phased out. And really, the big one was the introduction of, say, the 3.5-litre Formula One-style, normally aspirated engines. In hindsight, when you look back on that, Richard, what do you think were the deciding factors of its demise, apart from what I just mentioned there?
Well, my view is that it's the same. Is the same now as it was then. Group C become too successful, really, for its own good.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere we went, there were huge crowds. The TV figures were getting right up there with F1. And the powers that be didn't like it. And I'm not sure now, really. It was Bernie and, well, Balestra was in the mix as well, because Balestra was the president of the FIA in the lead up to that. To be honest, it's so confusing, the politics, but there was FISA, and Balestra was FISA, then he became FIA, and then Max Mosley somehow or other ousted Balestra. And these changes all happened around that time.
Mm.
And it was just too successful, and it was a genuine threat to F1.
Yeah, and Bernie Ecclestone, he was in charge of Group C at that point. If I remember correctly.
Yes, he took it over. He took it over to kill it.
Obviously.
And he did.
Yes. I mean, I looked back on some of the news reports and, you know, some of the opinion pieces that were written at the time, and it just didn't seem to come up. I don't know whether it was a case that journalists at the time were afraid to say it, but in hindsight, you could see it. It was written on the wall. You know, any modern person with journalists now would say, oh, that's the end of Group C. I mean, like, you can see any business venture like that, you know that when two car companies come together and they were both rivals and one of those car companies buy their, you know, it's a long shot that both of them are going to have an equal standing coming out of that. So it just came across very strange that no one actually was saying, you know, trying to raise a red flag and say, look, this is the end of Group C. What are we going to do about it? And it seemed to be that as well, following the fact that it was collapsed. I mean, there was a lot of confusion in sports car racing, probably until they came up with the idea of the GT1 series, which featured the McLaren F1, the Porsche and the Mercedes and so on. That type of racing, though, Richard, it proved to be very popular until it was also outlawed in favour of, you know, the what we have currently, the Le Mans prototypes. I wanted to ask you, in the 1990s, you saw the GT1 category, and it was replaced, obviously, by LMP. Were you a fan of the GT1 series and the LMP cars that are currently around?
Well, yes, because I've driven GT cars a lot. I mean, we could do 10 podcasts on.
We sure could.
Probably the cars. But I mean, as early as in the 82, I drove a 9. Oh God, I get all these
935
with Tony Dron and Richard Clear, and we won our class. Get that one in. Yeah. And just whilst we're on that subject, I also won my class in 78. In Group 6. So, and then moving on to GT1, I only ever drove one, and that was the Ferrari F40, which was a good match for the GT Porsche, I think. And I loved that car, but I didn't have many runouts in it. But I still drive that car, actually, because it's owned by an Italian friend of mine, and he lives near Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a regular race for you know, whatever they are, classic Italian classics and stuff, and we give it a run out at Vallelonga every so often. So I'm still there. I'm still having a go now and then.
So you think that the introduction of the GT1 category was a really good replacement for Group C?
Yes, I think it was, and it didn't become as big a threat to F1. So whether that meant it was less of a success, I don't know. But all this racing revolves around Le Mans at mm-hmm. the end of the day. The championships are designed for cars that run at Le Mans, and you can't get an entry for Le Mans unless you do the whole championship or series, whatever it is, whatever. Unless you're Peugeot, of course, then you can just turn up for Le Mans and it's all right. those GT1 cars were spectacular at Le Mans. So there's hardly a category I've driven in, Ken, that I haven't embraced and enjoyed immensely. But the more horsepower, the better, of course. I don't like the, but yes, it was great.
Do you think that the fact that the, you know, sports car racing, whether it be GT, sports prototype, open top cars, whatever, that they generally revolve around Le Mans, do you think that's a positive thing or a negative thing? Because that doesn't seem to happen in, say, Formula One. There, although we have Monaco, but, you know, Formula One would survive probably without Monaco. But sports car racing, as you say, it seemed to revolve around Le Mans. So is that a good thing or a bad thing, in your opinion?
I think it's a good thing. Mm. It gives it a nucleus. Everybody, that's why I think they changed it to the Le Mans Championship or the Le Mans Series, isn't it? You know, I think they call it. It's not a championship; it's a series. But you still have to do every round, or you won't get your Le Mans entry. So it's like I don't know. It's like I'll use a footballing analogy again. You know, you've got to go and do all. You've got to play all the rounds of the FA Cup to get to the final, haven't you? So I mean, it's like the final.
Like the Holy Grail or the top, yeah. The top table, and you know,
which is why they obviously it's all been upset by COVID this year, but they run the series from mid year to mid year with Le Mans being the final. If you see what I mean? So that's the yeah. That, so it is. It's the nucleus for it all, and I think that's a good thing.
And I just we're going to touch briefly on your actual career racing at Le Mans. I wanted to talk to you about one of your more prolific races, which was 1988, I think. And you were on board for the Spice Heart, which was, I think it's SE86C. You raced with a fellow Irishman, Martin Berain. Did you like Martin? Was he a good guy to race alongside?
Martin was a wonderful guy. Mm. And he's a real loss to both sides of the Irish Sea. Usually successful businessman in London, property developer, but always a gentleman. And I never, ever heard a bad word about Martin Berain, wow. either commercially or at the racing scene. And I think I can say this. He had quite a badly handicapped son who was a lovely lad. Or is, hopefully, I'm sure he still is a lovely lad. And he would, not every time, but regularly, Martin would bring him to the track. And he was physically fine, but he had a bit of, I think, learning difficulties, and he was just a joy to have around, and that's how, you know, he really got a heart, that guy. And I sadly miss him anyway, for one. I'm sure a lot of people do.
I think Martin, you know, in terms of Irish motor racing, you know, he's like the Moses. He kind of brought the mountain to Ireland rather than trying to get Ireland to compete. So many drivers who came out of the scene in the 1970s owe their, you know, their careers to Martin, because he kept, like, we had only got one track at the time, Mondello. It was in a pretty sad state till Martin took it over. And, you know,
I drove it.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, he helped to bring that track up to a world standard. And, you know, drivers that came out of Ireland at the time, all of them speak so highly about him. And, you know, I don't know whether you noticed, Richard, but he also holds the record for the Irish land speed record as well.
And,
we the motorway was just about to be opened. It was a kind of a ring road that went around Dublin at the time in 1988, I think it was. And he took out, I can't remember what it was, I might guess that, and said it was probably a Chevron or something like that. And he took it out and broke the land speed record just before they opened it, you know. But then again, you see, only Martin could have probably got that. You know, he would have got permission to do that. But I wanted to ask you about his skill, because we're going to go back to the race that you participated in. Was he a really good driver, though? Because I'm not saying that he wasn't. I just don't know. I've never seen or heard Martin in action. So you raced alongside him. Was he a good driver?
Martin was an excellent long-distance driver. He was never going to put it you know, you wouldn't stick him on to, in to do the quali lap, to be honest. But he was incredibly consistent around Le Mans.
Which is what you need, especially at night then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you could rely on him to do those stints and punch in the times that were necessary, not necessarily the ones, you know, when you really had to press. You'd probably stick somebody else in then. But for especially for Le Mans and any long distance race, he was a great asset to the team.
But he was a complete package, I suppose.
In more ways than one.
Yeah, it's just as I said, he was a bit of a package because he probably bought a bit of sponsorship, a bit of kind of, you know, expertise and probably more decent size of professionalism to any team that he goes to.
Yeah, you certainly saw a lot of a large sign saying peer group on the cars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And let's talk about that race that you were in with Martin back in 1988. You qualified, I think, the Spice on pole position. Now, I want to ask you about something because I did my research. I was reading a book there which was written by Michael Cotton and Ian Briggs. It's kind of like the report of that race. Now, it says here, I'm not going to go into it verbatim, but apparently you were there just by chance because the driver who was listed to race at the team, because the team was actually Martin. Then there was Nick Adams, great driver from the UK. And then they had a guy called Bobby Orr, who was a stunt driver from the US. Now, apparently Bobby had a few problems getting comfortable in the car. And he had trouble, I think, getting a good, decent qualifying lap off. And then apparently what happened was he couldn't manipulate the pedals. And then he set off the fire extinguisher, apparently, while he was driving. So he was having a bit of a torrid time. But it just so turns out, and I think there's a slight bit of sarcasm here. It says that you just happened to be there with your gloves hat. So your gloves, helmet and racing overalls. Was that just by sheer chance? Or was there a bit of a story behind that, Richard?
Well, there's always a bit of a story behind a lot of things, isn't there? But, but Bobby, I mean, he just didn't fit in the car. I mean, it was as simple as that. He's a big guy. And I think he got size 14 feet. So, and I think
that's pretty big for a racing driver, all right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unless you're racing monster trucks or something like that.
Yeah. Needless to say, he was a bit of a character. He arrived with the biggest motorhome, you know, and there are some big motorhomes there, which all became very handy. But I mean, he was physically too big to drive the car.
Yeah.
It was as simple as that. But I mean, as I touched on earlier, I think I am a bit of a journeyman, and I think it was a week before or 2 weeks before, Hugh Chamberlain phoned me up and said, "Rich, I think you better be on standby here." So I was on standby, and what we thought might happen did happen.
But it turned out to be a pretty good race for you guys, though, didn't it? I mean, you did quite well.
Yeah. But, I'm trying to think.
You didn't last the race.
We got across the line. No,
yeah.
We didn't last.
Yeah, I mean, technically.
I think we were so many different races, and I can't remember why we retired in the end. But
I think it was a broken drive shaft. I think that's what took you out.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
Was that just hard wear and tear on the track? Was Le Mans so hard on a car that it would shear a drive shaft?
Yeah, but I mean, the Spice was, I think, well, if it got a bang, maybe it's from. I think that if you didn't touch anything, it shouldn't have done that. But I mean, drive shafts go, don't they? I mean, it does happen, but it's usually as a result of some sort of contact. And even if you get away with the contact initially, it'll manifest itself later. So that's
I think it got stuck in the sand at some point. I think Martin might have spun a bit.
Well.
And so that probably.
Oh, right. Well, it wasn't me in the sand. I'd remember that. Yeah.
And just to touch on.
It was Martin in the car, was it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that was unusual for Martin because he would normally, you know, very. But if the drive shaft snapped on him, then, yeah.
Yeah.
He'd be lucky to finish in the sand.
I wanted to touch on something there because you mentioned it earlier on when you were talking about the Group 6 cars. In terms of, say, what their preference was, do you think generally drivers at that time preferred open-top cars or closed cars?
Yeah, well, at Le Mans, I always like to drive open cars. But, I mean, with Group C, it didn't become an option. There wasn't one to drive. So, you just adapt and get on with it.
But, were they particularly hot, say, for example, now, driving inside a Group C?
Oh, no, because you got good airflow through the car. Some races, some years when it was stinking hot outside, yeah, you could get very, very warm, but it didn't make that much difference to the open cars, because with the open cars you didn't get any air through because so in a way it wasn't much different.
And there was one thing I wanted to ask you about, because I mean obviously only somebody with your experience can convey what this feels like. Everyone has driven at night, and you know the instinct when you're driving at night is to obviously be a lot more careful and slow down. So how can you drive at night and try and, you know, go faster if needs be than you did during the day? What is it? What's the trick?
Oh, the trick is to concentrate, perhaps a little bit harder, but not much.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that the lights these days are amazing. And, I mean, they're so good. And the downside of that is when you've got the cars behind you, of course, because they've got good lights as well. But you somehow learn to adapt. You don't even need to look in your mirrors to know that they're there. So I would always, you know, you just use your periphery vision for the light. Don't stare at your mirror or your wing mirrors. Because you don't need to, because the lights are so bright, you know who's there and you can tell which side they're on.
Yeah.
But you can still just keep looking straight ahead.
Did you prefer driving at night to, say, during the day?
I love driving at night.
Really? Wow.
It's something magical.
Yeah.
Oh, you're really going to think I'm a nutter now, because I used to love it at night in the rain. I mean, it's
on slicks. Just for the hell of it. Just stick the slicks on, just for the hell of it.
Oh, no. It didn't have that. They didn't get that mad. But the other interesting thing about Le Mans, just whilst we're talking about the night, is the stint when you're going from pitch black to light. Because what happens then, we're assuming a dry track here, there's always a lot of accidents because the drivers tend to relax. It's coming daylight, we've got through the night, maybe even speed up. And it's a very dangerous time, because the track's been covered in a dew, even though it hasn't been raining.
Right.
But the dew is in the cracks in the track. But when it gets daylight, the light gets on the track, the dew comes down, yeah, and it raises the oil to the surface. So the track always gets very slippery as the dawn comes up, and it catches a lot of people out. So, of course, when I always mention this to the in the team briefing before, look, whoever's in the car at that point, don't forget this. And they say, 9 times out of 10, say, right, okay, you've got that stint. So I talk myself into it then. And it does. It's taken a lot of cars out. Always accidents first thing in the morning.
Was it? I do remember that a lot of drivers, when, say, they were being interviewed or during the commentary for the Daytona 24 Hours, there's a problem, because of being during the winter, that there's a problem with the sunlight in between, say, sunset and sunrise, isn't there? It's difficult to drive at that time in Daytona, isn't it?
Well, coincidentally, yes, and it is. There's a particular place. Well, Le Mans is a classic as well, actually, because it's where, as the sun is going down at Le Mans, when you come out of the Mulsanne bend, you know, at the end of the Mulsanne Strait, you turn right to head off down to Indianapolis, and the sun, is absolutely on the horizon all the way down there through those kinks on the way down to Indianapolis. You've got the sun right in your eyes, and that is a nightmare. It's not easy, that. But it doesn't last too long. The sun's soon gone. So you probably only got 2, maximum 3 laps to cope with.
Gotcha.
Like that.
Mm. So,
Daytona, yeah. Well, I mean, it's an oval, isn't it? You're going to get the sun somewhere all the time.
Absolutely.
Every lap.
So just to ask you, say, when you're driving in a 12-hour race, say like Sebring, and then you have a 24-hour race in Le Mans, do they require a completely different style of driving?
That's an interesting question. So I don't think there is. Every track's got different characteristics. Mm-hmm. So, and obviously, and Le Mans and Sebring are both very different in different ways to almost all the other places. So I think they've both got very long straights. So they're similar in that regard. Obviously, Sebring's a lot shorter. But the actual focus during racing not a lot of difference, no. Mm.
And for you, was Le Mans the greatest track you've ever driven at? Was it your favourite?
Oh, I'm so old. I remember the old the old Spa before they shortened it. I mean, I love Spa, but that old Spa track was magical again at night, because I did quite a few saloon, the 24-hour races at Spa in the saloon cars, which mm-hmm. in its day was fantastic, you know, when there were those, you know, the BMW 6 Series where they were with Stuck and all those boys. And that was a fantastic track. Mm-hmm. It's a toss-up between both Spas and Le Mans.
Yeah. And just to ask you another question, say, without too much details, when you were driving a Group C, did you have a favourite co-driver that you always like to say, sit in the car alongside with?
Yes. And we've already mentioned his name, or you have.
Yeah.
And it's Nick Adams.
Right, Nick Adams,
and just to put the record straight as well, that year when we were on pole, it was Nick that did the pole lap.
Right.
He just pit me by about a tenth of a second. We were very, very similar, and we had a very, well, I say have. I see a lot of Nick. We're still very close friends, and he's a director of the BRDC, so we see a lot of each other at meetings and things. But we were very similar style, and he would say, we complimented each other because we had such a similar style. That, you know, when I handed over to him, he would say, oh, the car felt just the same as that. And, you know, when he handed it over to me, it was, I mean, we looked after the brakes, we looked after the gearbox, and I'll say it, we were pretty damn quick as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was always special driving with Nick.
And overall, say, in terms of Group C, was it your favourite category that you've ever raced in? It's okay to say no now.
Was the Spice my favourite car?
No, actually driving in Group C. I mean, was Group C as a category your favourite category to race in?
Well, it's so difficult to state which one is my favourite, because I drove a lot of single-seaters. I did the Aurora Formula One Championship in
the UK.
An Ensign, which was a bit of a dog, but the Surtees I drove was a fantastic car. I drove F2 cars and Formula 3000 lot in the British Formula 3000 Championship, and I think my heart's with single seaters, to be honest.
Really?
But, okay. Which is probably what I shouldn't say.
No, but that's fine. Racing is racing, but, you know.
No, but I mean, it's single seaters. It's a younger man's thing, and it's a natural progression to go from that. Which sort of you know, you made me feel very old when you were a teenager in the 80s, Ken. I loved it all, Ken. I really don't want to say one was better than the other. It was that dome and the speed down the Mulsanne.
Yeah.
The trouble was, it wouldn't go around any of the other corners. It was fantastic down the straight, but it was very long and very narrow. The very, very long wheelbase and very narrow. So. Yeah. It was very, very quick down the... But as soon as you got to the Porsche curve, everybody was all over you.
Yeah.
You know? But anyway.
Looking back, say, on Group C, was the Spice the most, say, reliable, enjoyable car to drive in Group C?
Yes. In a word.
They just nailed it, didn't really they? When they designed that car, say, and when it developed over the, say, 3 or 4 years that it was kind of at the top tier. But they really nailed it first time. I mean, it looked like it just came out of the box ready to go.
Yeah. Well... Gordon Spice, another friend of mine who did all that. I mean, he was a very, very quick driver, but he was a good, you know, he knew what he wanted from a car, and he delivered that, as you say, straight out of the box.
Yeah.
I'm not sure who built the actual chassis. It's probably, you know, Lola or something, actually.
I think it was done. I know Graham Humphreys designed the actual cars themselves. And I'm just trying to guess. I think it was probably designed. I think they had their own factory, didn't they? They manufactured it themselves. Okay. I think,
right?
If I remember correctly, I think it was built in. I know, wasn't Ray Bellum involved in it as well? He was involved.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, of course he was. Yeah.
So I think they actually manufactured. They were constructing their own cars around 86, I think it was, and then they. They got a big deal with Pontiac, I think, in America, and that gave them a lot of orders. Yeah. I mean, but then again, the car actually looked slightly American with that kind of heart, you know, that kind of teardrop style at the back of it. It looked more like a GT car than it did look like than a Group C car. It didn't have that kind of oval style in, you know, head on it, like a cover. It was like this kind of swoopy back, and I think that appealed to the American market, yes. You know.
Yeah, because I drove an IMSA Spice at Sebring, and there was a difference. There was, I think it was engines, weren't there?
Yeah, they had Pontiacs. I know the Pontiacs ran in America.
So it had a different feel to it, but it was still a lovely car to drive.
Yeah, and get the right tires on it.
Listerine, probably paid for it.
Listerine, okay. Yes. Nice fresh start to the day.
Ray Bellum's dad's company.
Oh, I see, right, okay. Sorry. What are your thoughts on, say, the current state of motor racing around the world? Say, sports car racing. What do you think of sports car racing currently?
Well, it's been obvious for obvious COVID reasons. It's been an incredibly strange year, so to get a really current feel for it is difficult. But I think considering that and the amount of races that they've managed to do, and that the regulation changes for next year, which sound great. I mean, talking about normally aspirated V12 engines and things like that. So that sounds pretty exciting to, somebody of my era. That,
yeah.
You know, perhaps they'll make a proper noise again.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So I'm confident. I'm hopeful for the future of it all.
Do you eventually see, though, an electric car or a hydrogen-powered car winning at Le Mans? Do you think it's inevitable?
Yeah, matter of time. I'm sure. I think maybe a combination of hydrogen and electric.
Yeah.
Not that I'm technical enough to know if that's
ideal. I think that's the ideal combination. Like it's fueled, the fuel cells are electrical, but they're being powered by hydrogen gas. And I think that's do you think the way the world is going, I mean, climate change and so on, that the internal combustion engine is probably in its twilight anyway, would you agree?
Oh, yes. Yes, I know. It's just I'm going to be kicking and screaming into that era, but I understand the inevitability.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, I do think that there's still a long time, you know, for it to go, because, I mean, you know, I'm in the classic car business a lot, and a lot of people come to me and give me, you know, the conversation. They want the conversation with me about my cars, for example. I have two or three old cars, and, you know, people say to me, oh, are you not, like, you know, you should be contributing to the environment and keeping them off the road. But you and I know, if you were to add up all of the classic motor racing cars, all of the classic cars around the world, and look at the percentage that they are in the world compared to the rest of the cars, to say everyday models of cars, it's minute. It doesn't make any kind of impact on the environment, really. So I think, you know, I think the same applies to motor racing, because if you were to add up all of the motor racing cars that are currently, say, racing, again, it's tiny, you know, because you only have like 20 cars in Formula One every year racing. What, in 20 races? So I think there's still a bit of time for the internal combustion engine to last for a while. But I suppose it's an exciting adventure, you know, when you think about it. You know, everything is, you know, that motor racing wouldn't be exciting if it didn't develop. I mean, would we still want to be driving in cars like that are completely unsafe and wearing leather helmets? I don't think anybody would agree to that, so.
No, I totally agree. But going back to your older cars, I think we've got to look after our heritage, haven't
definitely.
We?
Definitely.
They've got to be around for our kids and grandkids and
couldn't
all
agree
that
more.
I throw that
argument to people about steam engines. You know, if we had adopted the same attitude about steam engines, you know, they wouldn't be around. And we have a huge, where I am in Kildare in Ireland, we have a huge steam engine get-together every year. I mean, you're talking like 100, 150 steam working engines coming over from the UK and Europe. And these are like incredible engineering. They require the most amazing type levels of engineering to keep them running. And, you know, the contribution to the environment is zero, but they have to be here. And I think the same is going to apply in terms of classic cars and classic motor racing cars, because if we lose that, we're losing a huge part of our heritage. Even if it's kind of something that we look back on and say, you know, it didn't do our environment pretty good. But I think as long as we kind of think that we need to develop, and that's what I love about motor racing, and I'm sure you know this because you've been at the front of that. The best technologies, ABS brakes, power steering, they all started in motor racing.
Oh, yeah. Disc brakes. At Le Mans. You know, the Jaguar D-Type, I think, was the first one.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, we have to have motor racing, I'm quite sure. What do you think of, say, the young drivers at the moment? Do you think that they're a different type of driver now?
I think they've been brought up in this modern era, and their technical abilities are second to none.
Yeah.
I think they're fantastic, bright, young, highly intelligent guys, and would run circles around me on that side. And all good credit to them. And yeah. there's some really good, exciting talent coming through.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a tough one because there's so many of them, and only a few can actually make it. But
yeah,
and I think what's helped them enormously of these been the quality of the simulators these days.
Yeah, and what do you think of The Sims? Do you think The Sims are a good idea? Because that was going to be my next question.
Was it? All right.
Yeah.
So it leads into nicely. Yeah. I mean, it's like you were talking about electric cars and hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't. They're there. Yeah. And the teams are going to use them. And so it's just more innovation, and but I mean, I can remember driving simulators, you know, way back, but I mean, they're just so much different now. I mean, to the point where you can feel every bump in the road on every circuit around the world if you plug in the right disc, you know. It's incredible. It's so real, and that must be a massive benefit. But all their competitors, all these young guys that are racing against each other, they've all got that same advantage.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just natural now. It's a part of being a modern professional racing driver.
Yeah. And then you look at the steering wheels alone. I mean, how many buttons are there on them?
I mean, they're like something out of the Millennium Falcon in Star Wars. And they're getting more and more technical, and there's so much more control.
Yeah.
And I presume you'd call that distraction as well, wouldn't you? I mean, you talked about earlier on about concentrating. I mean, having to invest your level of concentration into other things while, as you say, plummeting down Mulsanne Strait at, you know, 200 kilometers per hour in the rain, you know, at night, and having to flick a switch here, there, and everywhere. It must be quite daunting.
Yeah. I just struggle to find the radio button. Oh, not quite. But
which actually, Richard, just one last question. I didn't intend to ask you this question, but now that we've spoken about this, I think this is something I'd like to ask you. Did you see the recent movie, you know, Le Mans 66? Did you manage to get a chance to see that film?
Oh, yes, yeah.
What did you think of that movie?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. And I didn't know that story. I mean, that guy that lost it, because he obeyed team orders.
Yeah.
Somebody, was it? But it was brilliantly done,
Actually, that's what I was asking you about. Did you say to yourself, wow, that looks pretty authentic?
Well, no, not, well, it wasn't the Mulsanne Strait they were on.
Yeah, okay, you got that. Yeah.
But I think they've got Indianapolis and Arnage, sort of thing. Maybe a bit, because it was pre-Porsche cars.
So. Yeah, yeah. And did they capture? But did they capture the essence of, you know, those cars?
Yes. Yeah. Oh no, they definitely captured the essence. But my only criticism was that it wasn't the Mulsanne Strait. Mm. But I suppose it would have cost a few quid to shut that down.
Probably.
It?
Yeah, that's it.
For a bit of filming.
Yeah,
but if you didn't know as well, you would. So I think for the general public, that wasn't the problem.
Yeah,
and I thoroughly enjoyed it anyway.
I think the movie worked in terms that it managed to have people who were watching it who weren't interested at all in motor racing, but the story, as you say, was a very, you know, a very rich and good story that needed to be told. You know, and Richard, I just wanted to ask you as well. What are you doing at the moment? Are you still involved in motor racing?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Very much so. I'm doing track days. I'm available for coaching. I go all over the country doing it, but particularly I'm sort of a product manager, whatever you want to call. Not manager. That's the wrong word.
You're an influencer, Richard.
I'm an influencer, for Cataclean, that's it. I'm getting all these new technologies. Podcasts, another one.
What's Cataclean, Richard? Tell us all about that. That sounds like something to do with engine power.
It's fuel additive. It cleans all of your catalytic converters, all of the pistons, the cylinders, the valves. It cleans everything right through. It increases the power, but one of its big points is that if you take your car for an MOT and it fails on the emissions, you put a bottle of Cataclean in it, drive it around for 20 minutes, half an hour, take it back and it'll pass.
Right, gotcha.
Or it will almost certainly pass, I suppose I should say.
And you can find the products on...
Cataclean, Yeah.
Great stuff. And you're involved with that. And also, come here, they do a bit of racing, don't they? I think they sponsor the British Touring Car Championship, isn't it? One of the cars there?
Yes, that's right. Yep. A team called Sicily, Mercedes.
Super.
And so I've helped coach some of their, they've got some younger drivers coming through, so I'm helping with that.
That car looks pretty spectacular. I'm just looking at it here online, and it's doing this black and white. It looks pretty cool.
And I'll mention Dan, our driver, Dan Robotham. Mm-hmm. He got, you know, because of all the COVID, touring cars happened in the end, but we'd already arranged a deal to run in a NASCAR in Europe. So that's been very exciting. And but we are looking for a comeback in British Touring Cars next season, so watch this space on that one.
Okay, and they're sponsored, of course, by Cataclyn, who you are an influencer for. Let's give you that lovely modern title. I mean, what a man to have an influence on. And, of course, then you are still, I mean, do you still do do you do any kind of historic racing or anything like that?
Well, I'm hoping, the Ferrari F40 that we talked about in the meeting, I drive that, which is excellent. And I do quite a bit of setup for the chevrons. Are a bit of my speciality.
Excellent.
Because that was my earliest sports car experience in chevrons and in the Group 6 days, which we've discussed already. And I'm keeping my hand in. I'm keeping fit.
Anybody wants to get in touch with you, Richard, they can get in touch with me, and I will pass on my details. Or you're on Facebook as well, aren't you? That's how I got you. So you're easy man to find on Facebook.
That's brilliant.
That's the way we want it. Richard, listen, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been really brilliant. We could have talked for another hour, I think. There's about a million other questions I would love to ask you, which probably wouldn't be good for a recording.
I'll tell you what then. When all this COVID nonsense is over, I'll come over and we'll go and have a pint somewhere, and I'll give you I'll tell you the unedited version.
That would be brilliant. The director's cut.
Exactly.
Richard, thanks a million for taking the time today.
Been a pleasure, Ken. Thank you for having me, as I say.
Lovely. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.